our presence and her presence, I give you Willie B. from Texas.
I will. My name is Willie, and I am an alcoholic. And I know that's the truth because I have a piece of paper here that says, your name is Willie, and you're an alcoholic. I've had an inner ear infection, so my equilibrium is a little bit off. I have not been drinking. I have not been taking pills. My inner ear is going from one side to the other, but y'all be patient. Okay. God, it's good to see everybody. The new faces. How many people, this is my first shot in here, so how many people are new to the seminar, have never been before? Oh, great. All my people that I've seen year after year after year, it's such a joy to see your faces again. Maybe I don't remember your names, but it's so good to see a familiar face. Faces I don't forget. I haven't found it absolutely necessary to have a drink of alcohol since June the 19th, 1957. Yeah, I know. There's always a young'un that turns to his companion and said, my God, she's been sober longer than I've been born. That's okay down there. Don't come up here and say that to me. It sort of hurts my feelings and makes me realize, you know, just how cotton-picking old I'm getting. Now, I hear there's people from Philly and New York and Jersey and all these places that don't spend much time in the South, so I want to clarify this to start with. I talk funny. I was born and raised in Texas, lived all over the world for 20 years, but then went back and I'm rooted in Texas. And I never tried to change the way I talk because us Texans are sort of lazy and we just don't like to change stuff. We just keep going. A lot of my expressions, maybe, you know, you'll have to get an interpreter, but I try not to pretend to be anything but what I am, and that's a Texan just talking funny. I'll say y'all quite a bit, and I'll explain to the Yankees back there. Y'all is just plural for all y'all. So that way I don't miss anybody. This is the 67th Big Book Seminar that we, the three of us, have held together, with another Joe starting out with us. We started back in 1983 in Pompano Beach, Florida. That was our first one. And we've been going ever since, just like a bunch of little robots. But it's been a beautiful experience for us. It renews my spirit every time I do a seminar. We were doing back-to-back, wall-to-wall in the very beginning. But then we began to narrow down and take it to foreign countries and various things. And it's been quite an experience. And I hope that you'll let me this weekend just share with you and you sharing with me, because your faces do share. That's why I like the podium. I can't sit there because I can't see everybody. But this way, and maybe that's just, you know, my curiosity. I want to see how many people go to sleep back there. But see, being an old ex-school teacher, taught for 37 years, I don't mind if you want to take a nap. Just don't make a lot of noise doing it, and I won't mind a bit. Doesn't hurt my feelings. Okay. My job this weekend is to cover this beautiful 12 and 12. That's the job I was given to start with by the great Wesley Parrish that started this whole thing. Where's Wesley? Oh, okay. And he started this, and he called me and he said, Willie, I'd like for you to join these two men and do the 12 and 12. They'll be doing the big book, so you stay out of the big book, and they'll stay out of your 12 and 12. And that's how it started back in 83. And he gave me a job that I have really, really enjoyed. I hope that if you haven't gotten into your 12 and 12, how many people have less than 5 years? Okay. Good for these newcomers. God, I'm glad to see you. But, and of course, our, as we'll read here, that big book is what you're in now. But I hope as you go along, you'll combine in with your 12 and 12. It was written 13 years later, after the big book was published. It was written and put together by those that had gotten inquiries from all over the country about, you know, Bill, what did you mean by this? Of course, the big book couldn't contain every single thought in the world that Bill had. They had to sit on him to combine enough so that the book wouldn't be that big to really be a big book. But in 13 years, he realized that maybe they could add to this program by writing a day by day. And he tells it here in the foreword. Let's look together. It's on page 15. Not a lot of light up here. Best we can do is okay. Okay. It's not my eyesight. It's the fact that they don't have no. No. Bring me a flashlight. It says that Alcoholics Anonymous is a worldwide fellowship of more than 100,000. And, of course, that was in 84. 100,000 alcoholic men and women who are banded together to solve their common problems and to help fellow sufferers in recovery from that age-old, baffling malady, alcoholism. This book deals with the 12 steps and the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. It presents an explicit view of the principles by which AA members recover and by which their society functions. AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which, if practiced as a way of life, is just simply a daily type living, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. And I didn't know it, but in the beginning, that's what I wanted, to be put back together. Because I couldn't do it. I had tried. But I sort of always felt like a jigsaw puzzle. You went to the store and you bought this beautiful jigsaw puzzle. The picture on the box was nice. You got it home, you flipped it out on the table, and you had all these pieces scattered all over. Even a few underneath the table where you had dropped them. But the thing of it is, they still told you about that picture. Keep looking at the picture, Willie. And I was scattered in so many different pieces. Alcohol had taken me. I hear a lot of times, you know, alcohol abused me. It did. And I let it. I invited it to come in. And kept inviting and kept inviting. I was young. I was in my 20s and they just weren't coming in bunches of young people back then, and very few women. And now you men, we'll qualify this to start with. You have two beautiful men up here all weekend. Us gals, you have one. And so I'm going to be directing a lot of my remarks to the women. And don't you men get your nose out of joint, because you usually don't. You've been real cooperative all these years. But every once in a while, I'm going to say something to the women because they're going to be talking to y'all. So, but in that beginning, I felt like I could not put these pieces together when they were telling me about all of the things that I needed to do and all the ways I needed to think. And being in groups all over the country with just mainly men, once in a while we'd have a stray woman come through. But in the 50s, there weren't very many. And the men tried so hard to help me. God, they tried every way they could think of. But I needed me a gal, and I finally got one when we were transferred down to Montgomery, Alabama. So men, maybe the gals haven't found quite somebody they can latch on to, because we'll talk about that problem later. So y'all be patient. But in another little thing I have, you better be following with your finger, because I skip and stop and start. And, yeah, hear those rumblings from the people that have been here. But that's the only way I can do it. So if I, you'll be better off if when I stop talking on what's in the book, keep your finger right there. Because I'm going to pick up, but I might be off in Neverland in between. But when they dazzle me with that, to be usefully whole, not just whole, but I wanted to be useful because I had been so useless for so long to anybody. You know, us drunks have the ability to kill people that don't even drink. And we kill more than just physical. We kill their trust in people. We kill so bad the peace of mind. So I had not only been scattered myself, I'd scattered a whole bunch of other people that tried to love me through it. And we're not real easy to love. Okay, on page 17, at the big, long first paragraph there, go down to say the book Alcoholics Anonymous. The book Alcoholics Anonymous became the basic text of the fellowship, and it still is. This present volume proposes to broaden and deepen the understanding of the 12 steps as first written in the earlier works. So see, it is our second basic text, and it's so much help when you're working with other people. Such a beautiful tool. And when they talk about the principles, broadening the depth of this program, they will. There's none that are written in stone, but I have a set that was given to me way back in the early 60s by a man that had been in with some of the founders. And he told me he had worked out his own little set of principles because he was baffled in the beginning by that 12th step that says to use all these principles in all of our affairs. Joe and Charlie will stress that when they get to it. And there's no list any place sealed up in a safe up in New York. But these are the ones that this beautiful man handed to me that he had worked out on his own so it would help him when he worked with new people. I'm going to pass those on to you this weekend. Each step I do, I'll pass on. Those that John does, I will backtrack and give you those. It's easier than trying to get them all in one thing. So our principle there, as it ends up on the forward on page 18, last paragraph. It's hoped that this volume will afford all who read it a close-up view of the principles and forces which have made Alcoholics Anonymous what it is. And those of us that have been around a couple of days, we know what it is. Our principle in step one is honesty. That's on page 21. Honesty and acceptance, and they go together little by little by little. We can't get honest the minute we come in and start saying, I'm an alcoholic. Many of us, it took us a while to make it. It took me 4 years of sitting in those meetings, mouthing that I was an alcoholic before I actually accepted it. And what they explained to me was that this principle of honesty and acceptance should start being a daily part of our lives. Because honest, we've walked a many a mile away from that principle. A drunk can't continue to drink and be honest. Not only about our drinking, it boils over into other areas. It did in mine. It boiled over into my sober areas. I was not a 24 around-the-clock drinker. I was a spree drinker. But see, in between, I couldn't break the habit of lying. And Bill explains that so well in this first step. But I needed to start practicing anything, any part of my life that I want to change. I can't just say, I'm changed. It's a practical thing. And it's practicing in all the little areas, let alone the big areas. That's not where I had been dishonest, not in big areas, but all those little things. I'd, you know, climb a tree to tell a lie rather than stand flat-footed on the ground and tell the truth. Because the truth always never did. I had not dealt with it in so long that it was a part of my being when I opened my mouth. I would start out with a little tiny, but then here came the big one. And we can't operate. I couldn't have held on to my man for as long as I did for the rest of my sobriety. I couldn't have held on to him if I wouldn't have broken that habit of lying to him when I was stone cold sober. He didn't pay attention to, you know, when I lied about my drinking. But what puzzled him was maybe the 3 and 4 months between drunks that I'd go, they'd be lying in between. And that didn't go over so big. Okay. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. I think that tells us something there. We're powerless over alcohol, but all the in-between of our lives was unmanageable. And I realized after being told 15 times that it would become a problem again if I let my life, my sober life, become unmanageable. That I had to keep that straightened up too. Not perfect, just in balance. But I think when we read that first paragraph, think about what it really says. Who cares to admit complete defeat? Practically no one, of course. Every natural instinct cries out against the idea of personal powerlessness. Now, he's talking about human beings there. God, it's hard to admit that we are powerless over anything. As an ordinary human being, you can look down into the little kid's eyes and he'll say, I can do it. He didn't have the remotest idea how to go about doing it, but I can do it. It's an instinct that we're born with. What if we were different? What if the first obstacle we came up against, okay, that's it. Can't do it. Won't try again. What would become of the human race? Every natural instinct that we have from being a little fellow's on up is to overcome an obstacle. You know, the best example is in another big book when it talks about Adam and Eve. They were in this paradise. They had everything they could possibly want. Except one thing. Obstacle here. So they mull around with it for a while and then they screw everything up. You reckon somebody was trying to tell us something, whatever you believe in, or just the analogy of the story. You can do anything you want to, but this one thing. That's giving us an obstacle, and we wouldn't be complete human beings if we didn't try to overcome those obstacles. So, okay, we get in trouble with alcohol. People tell us, you ought to quit drinking. Okay. You're ruining your life. You're ruining your health. You're hurting all the people around you. Okay. There's the obstacle. What am I going to do with it? Say, okay, that's it. Never again. If you say so. So it was normal, honey, for you to try over and over and over again before you learned any better. That kid learns as he goes along that he better not volunteer to do something if he really doesn't know exactly how to do it. The smart ones do. But just even the normal kids will, you know, find out that they couldn't swim, so they stay out of the water. They went blub, blub, blub the first time they got in the pool. But what I'm trying to say is to realize what this paragraph is telling us. That it's not so out of the ordinary, hon, for you to keep over and over and over doing the same thing, trying to learn how to drink like a bunch of the people around you could. You sort of get where you sort of watch them, and they're having a good time and everything, and it's not bothering them like it's bothering you. and how you want to be able to do it. So you try over, you use every device in the world, and we can really come up with a lot of them. But it's normal, hon. It's a normal human instinct, not just for drunks. It said, it's truly awful to admit that, glass in hand, we have warped our minds into such an obsession for destructive drinking that only an act of providence can remove it from us. Down the bottom paragraph, we know that little good can come to any alcoholic who joins AA unless he has first accepted his devastating weakness and all of its consequences. Not just devastating weaknesses, but all of the consequences. And when we get to looking back, we had a lot of consequences. So that tells me that I'm going to have to watch out in all the areas of my life, not just the drinking. Just because I quit drinking, all you got when you sober up a drunk is an undrunk drunk. That's all you got. So I'm going to have to look out for all of those consequences. Until he so humbles himself, his sobriety, if any, will be precarious. This book has a lot of promises in it, too. Some of them are negative, some of them are positive. But that's one. It says, until he so humbles himself, his sobriety, if any, will be precarious. Of real happiness, he will find none at all, proved beyond doubt by an immense experience. This is one of the facts of AA life. The principles that we shall find no enduring strength until we first admit complete defeat in every area. The main taproot from which our society, whole society, has sprung and flowered. When first challenged to admit defeat, most of us revolted. We had approached AA expecting to be taught self-confidence. Then we had been told that so far as alcohol was concerned, self-confidence was no good whatsoever. In fact, it was a total liability. I can do this. If I put my mind to it, I can do this. Our sponsors declared that we were the victims of a mental obsession so subtly powerful that no amount of human willpower could break it. There was, they said, no such thing as the personal conquest of this compulsion by the unaided will. Relentlessly deepening our dilemma, our sponsors pointed out our increasing sensitivity to alcohol. An allergy, they called it. I don't know why I balked at the fact that I was an alcoholic. I kept it in the mental bracket. Dr. Silkworth so very carefully found our answer for us. He explained it in the only way that it's still able to be explained. We got a whole bunch of folks here this weekend. And just to think, we all are alike. We all, have the same chemical makeup. We all have the same thoughts, attitudes, everything. We all have the same backgrounds. No, we come from all kinds of backgrounds, social, economical, everything you can think of, race, religion, everything, just in this room. And yet all of us are powerless over alcohol. There had to be a common, ordinary, not necessarily deep and psychological, because how are you going to compare people? Poor old psychologists were going crazy. They'd get one of us and they'd figure out. An alcoholic is. Did you ever see an alcoholic that is anything? No, the only thing predictable about an alcoholic is his unpredictability. Absolutely. When we're drinking. But that's the only comparison. And they're bound to have, to be a logical explanation for all of us getting into the same mental obsession of to keep trying to do something. There wasn't any really logical answer, but we kept looking for it. Why do I do this? Okay. And, of course, then about that time, they all came in and said it was because, prenatal or, from the cradle, how mother and daddy treated you, all this kind of stuff. That still didn't explain it. Because, see, I came from a little old town in Texas, little old German community, And when I say little old community, I'm talking, we didn't even have our own village idiot. We just all took turns. And I kept looking at that background, strong German farming community. People had come over here on the boat and settled in this part of Texas because of good farming, good water. Very calm, peaceful. Maybe when everybody was home, we had 300 people. I graduated in a class of 7 from high school. No, honey, I didn't say 70. 7. So this was a small, uncomplicated. I tried to convince the psychologist when they took me to one that the reason I was an alcoholic because I had such a boring childhood. Made sense to me because nothing ever happened there. But I couldn't, and I couldn't make it make sense. But when they said, Willie, read Dr. Silkworth's letter. He tells us we're allergic to alcohol. And I couldn't, you know, I didn't want to relate that in my mind until I was busy popping off about everything else. But I'm allergic to penicillin. I wasn't in the beginning, the first time they ever gave it to me back in the 40s when it was brand new. I wasn't allergic to it. But as I took it throughout the next 4 or 5 years, it got worse and worse. And the last time they gave me penicillin in the late 40s, I quit breathing. I had just had rashes before. Doctors didn't know too much about that miracle drug that had come in. And see, why I couldn't equate that to diabetes? People aren't, you know, mental incompetence that are diabetes. Why did I keep looking mental? I wasn't, you know, that wasn't the reason I was allergic to penicillin. It was physical. It was an allergy, and that allergy had grown. Many kids are allergic to penicillin the very first time they take it. Many little fellows are diabetics. Other people become diabetics as they get older and older and older. I don't know. I just didn't want it to be that simple. I didn't want my life to be that simple. I wanted it to be deep and real, you know, philosophical and all that kind of jazz. But I promise you, hon, when I took my fourth step and found out I was ordinary, God, it was a relief. Because that is a big relief to realize that I have a chemical allergy to alcohol and penicillin. And that there's nothing of a degenerate within me as far as understanding why I couldn't drink. And it was the only way that I could, why I couldn't explain that to myself sooner, I don't know. But it doesn't bother me anymore, but I make sure that when I get a new gal, honey, let's talk about your physical being. And it helps to know that Dr. Silkworth discovered that for us and tried to help us by explaining it. Chemically, my body doesn't handle it any better than my body handles penicillin. So big deal. Said the tyrant alcohol. See, I told you to keep your finger there. Because it's right after an allergy, they called it. The tyrant alcohol wielded a double-edged sword over us. First, we were smitten by an insane urge that condemned us to go on drinking, and then by an allergy of the body that ensured we would ultimately destroy ourselves in the process. If I took a shot of penicillin now, I'd be pretty stupid, because even though it's been all those years, I'm not going to take that chance, because I don't like not breathing. And especially now, you know, as I get older and older, I don't like not breathing. Few indeed were those who so assailed have ever won in through single-handed combat. It was a statistical fact that alcoholics almost never recovered on their own resources. That doesn't say, and we're the only ones that can help, but it assures us that our own resources, we're not going to do it. And this has been true apparently ever since man has first crushed grapes. In the pioneering times, none but the most desperate out cases could swallow and digest this unpalatable truth. Even those last gaspers often had difficulty in realizing how hopeless they actually were. But a few did. And when these laid hold of the AA principles, not stayed sober long enough when they laid hold of the AA principles with all the fervor with which the drowning seas life preservers, they almost invariably got well. That's why the first edition of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, published when our membership was small, dealt with low bottom cases only. Many less desperate alcoholics tried AA but did not succeed because they could not make the admission of hopelessness. I still had my marriage, I still had my man intact, the same one I'd started with, and I don't know how, but he hung in there. But I still had my job professionally. I'd been a teacher for all those years, and I still had my job. I'd never lost a job, never been fired. I was one of those that couldn't. I'm not in that bad a shape when I listen to the men that had lost their families, their children, their homes, everything they had. It is with tremendous satisfaction to record that in the following years, this changed. Alcoholics who still had their health, their families, their jobs, and even two cars in the garage began to recognize their alcoholism. As this trend grew, they were joined by young people who were scarcely more than potential alcoholics. So, honey, if you're hanging on the edge and you think, I'm just too young to be in the same shape all these old people are, that's why, don't say very much when I'm sitting in a meeting. Because I want them to identify. If we have three that are in their 20s, 18, 19, up and through there, I want them to listen to the younger ones so that they'll have that hope of, okay, if that about my age can do it, I can too. So I keep a low profile. They were spared that last 10 or 15 years of literal hell that the rest of us have gone through. Since step one requires an admission that our lives have become unmanageable, how could people such as these take this step? It was obviously necessary to raise the bottom the rest of us had hit to the point where it would hit them. By going back in our drinking history, we could show that years before we realized it was out of control, that our drinking even then was no mere habit, that it was indeed the beginning of a fatal progression. To the doubters, we could say, perhaps you're not alcoholic. Bill tells us in a letter he wrote in 1942, don't beat him to death. Poor old horse, when you hit him enough, will just leave him alone if he doesn't want to drink from the bucket. But he said, put the bucket down. Tell him everything that water has done for you. And pat him on the nose, put the water down, leave it there, and when he's ready to drink, he will. That's the parallel that he drew. Because you can't make a, especially if anybody here is from Texas or Oklahoma or any place, we got a lot of horses. Let there be light. Oh. You can't make a horse, even if he needs it bad. You can put his head down in the water and he won't move his lips. But put the bucket down, Bill says, right down beside him. And it contains what he needs, and he'll take it when he needs it. It's all right for us to encourage, but not to try to force, because we don't force so pretty good, because we're so defined at that point. To the doubters, we could say, perhaps you're not alcoholic at all. Why don't you try some more controlled drinking? And he explained in a letter what he meant by that when somebody asked, what is controlled drinking? Okay, you set up a period of, say, for instance, here's one way, 2 weeks, you're going to come home in the evening and you're going to drink two drinks or two beers or two of anything that you normally drink with alcohol. NyQuil, anything else. But two drinks, no more, but no less. For 2 weeks, every afternoon, you're going to come home and take those two drinks. Don't not drink and think that, I'm controlling it. I didn't drink tonight. Uh-uh. Drink those two drinks. And if you can do that for 2 solid weeks and never take that third one, you're not in bad trouble yet. Think about that. How many of us could do it? Or even want to try? Oh, dear God. If I was on a desert island and they left me all by myself with one bottle, I wouldn't touch it. If I wasn't a way to get some more, uh-uh. And I know that so well. Control drinking? 2 drinks every afternoon. No more, no less. It'll at least show you how hard you have to really start fighting it, and most of the time you're going to give up. Because I couldn't do it even now, after these years of sobriety. So it goes on to say, this attitude brought immediate and practical results. It was then discovered that when one alcoholic has planted in the mind of another the true nature of his malady, that person could never be the same. That's why you leave the bucket of water. That's why you tell them everything you can about yourself. Because the power that rules their life, whatever they come to believe in, he's sticking it in their pocket. He's making that old horse more and more interested in that water. As long as it's sitting there and don't do anything, all right, I'm through with you, blah, 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 blah. You need to know you're alcoholic and blah, blah, yeah. Tell the old horse. But then I never forgot anything those men in Omaha, Nebraska, Seattle, Washington, Rantoul, Illinois. My husband was an Air Force officer. We were stationed all over the world for 22 years. So I would go from one group of men to the next group, to the next group, to the next group. But all those men didn't try to force me. They tried to teach me through their own experience. But see, I wasn't ready to drink of the bucket. But I didn't forget anything they ever said. I thought nothing they may have said made any sense. I was sort of like this lion that ran across this bull one time, and the lion was hungry. So he killed the bull and ate it. All you old timers are ready for this story. But it makes the point like no other does, as far as I was concerned. He ate that bull, and he was so satisfied and ready to take a nap, but no. He has to go up on the hill and holler and yell and scream and beller and roar. Well, a hunter came along and shot him. Now, the moral to that story is, if you're full of bull, keep your mouth shut. And one of the men in Seattle, Washington, told me that story. And dadgummit, I couldn't forget it. Because I realized that my mouth was working and so hard when I would see these people, when I'd go to their dumb meetings. I would work my mouth so much that my ears weren't opened up very well. I couldn't hear what was being said because my mouth was going. So when he told me that story, it made more sense to me than any deep psychological junk that somebody sitting behind the desk could tell me. Okay, over on page 24, the light does help. While this insistent that every alcoholic must hit bottom first, our own personal, we have that deep inside. The answer is that few people will sincerely try to practice AA's program unless they have hit the bottom, unless they've gotten to that moment of surrender. And that doesn't mean a material bottom. It means a soul bottom, where you're so sick of yourself, you just can't do this anymore. As long as I said to myself, Willie, you need to quit drinking. You're ruining everything, your marriage, everything else. You need to. And when I change that one word, I want to do it. I want to do it. And that makes a difference. For practicing AA's remaining 11 steps means the adoption of attitudes and actions. Doesn't say anything about, not drinking. But an adoption of attitudes and actions that almost no alcoholic who is still drinking can even dream of taking. We can't take these actions when we're drinking. Who wishes to be rigorously honest and tolerant? Who wants to confess his faults to another and make restitution for harm done? Who cares anything about a higher power, let alone meditation and prayer? Who wants to sacrifice time and energy in trying to carry AA's mess to the next sufferer? No, the average alcoholic, self-centered in the extreme, doesn't care for this project unless he has to do these things in order to stay alive himself. Under the lash of alcoholism, we are driven to AA, and there we discover the fatal nature of our situation. Then and only then do we become as open-minded to conviction and as willing to listen as the dying can be. We stand ready to do anything, anything, which will lift the merciless obsession from us. You know, like I say, I came to AA to get sober. But thank God I've stayed to be changed. A little at a time. No magic wand was ever waved. But a little bit at a time. And the tools to do that, honey, is right here in both of our books. Just be patient. Give us a try. Give us a try. Run it up the flagpole. If no, you know, don't salute it. Well, you can always go back because the liquor's going to be there. It'll be there, I promise. I have no idea because my watch. I always take extra time when I won't. Okay. You know, when all this stuff started getting, alcoholism started getting so deep and psychological, when the all the stuff started where they started examining our minds to find out why we got drunk. So they had all these difficult questions, psychological ones that came in. And we had a fellow down in Texas named Wino Joe. And Wino got so sick of all these questions. He heard them and, you know, what about your upbringing? Was your daddy cross and mean? And did he spit when he went by you? And whatever, did he chew tobacco? And all these things that were supposed to have molded you into an alcoholic. And Joe got tired of him. He said he went into all these places and there's questions that they ask you to qualify to be an alcoholic. Got longer and longer, and he had just gone into one that had 6 pages of questions for the old drunk to answer before they were going to let him in to their facility. And Joe got tired of that. He made up his own questions. Joe had been sober a long time, and he was a mean drunk, and he wasn't named Wino for no unknown reason that anybody could figure out. He said when he came in, he had so many wine sores on him, you couldn't drop a quarter on him without hitting one. And he was a great down-to-earth fella, and he made up his own questions. Has the roof of your mouth ever been sunburned? Y'all have beaches around here. I know a lot of you Florida people might be able to identify with that. Going to sleep, in the sun. Have you ever been arrested while in jail? Have you ever been run over by your own car while driving it? Have you ever been spiritually inspired by the mildew markings on a shower curtain? See, these make sense to us, don't they? Because of the, and we didn't have to do those same things, but the insane things. We didn't get drunk in any different ways. A drunk is a drunk is a drunk. We stagger a lot, we fall down a lot, we babble a lot, we, you know, look around a lot to see who we can aggravate. The drunks out there tonight are going to be doing the same thing. Can you think of anything that you've never heard that a drunk does? No, it's not all that out of the ordinary. But the insanity that went along with our obsession, the different ways that we would try to manipulate other people into buying us a drink. I mean, we were movie stars down on our luck, and we had just lost a contract for a new picture, and we could go on and on sitting on that bar stool. All we were trying to do is filter drink. And they know we were lying, but it was amusing to watch us and to listen to us build this story. I'm a doctor that was kicked out of practice, you know. I'm a lawyer. Well, nowadays they wouldn't say that, but they would. If Stu's here, I love you, Stu. And you know I do. Couldn't resist that jab. But the insane things we would do, like hiding our bottles. You know, it wasn't easy to hide one up in the gutter to get to it, you know, when we had to figure out a way to when the husband or wife wasn't around, to go up in that gutter and get that bottle. And the insane places, a lot of people won't believe where we hid bottles. That's all right. They wouldn't be looking for them, would they, if they were around nowadays? My husband used to make a list so he could keep up because we kept moving. We were in different houses, and I would find different places. Every house we lived in had base quarters, had the little different cabinets and different closets and everything. He nearly went insane looking for those bottles. And it was the insanity of it. See, there was only the two of us in wherever we were living for the first 10 years. There were just the two of us. And he was flying in a terrible lot. Even when he went to Korea, he was gone 18 months. And that's when I started into the second phase of my allergy. It hadn't been bad. We'd done a lot of good drinking together. But there was something different about mine. It was getting different. And being as I didn't have the remotest idea, I kept trying to do it. But even when I was in that house by myself, I started hiding it. Who was going to find it? Insanity. So Joe's questions made good sense. It's amazing when we look back and think, you know, what in the world? How could we go back to that? Honey, think about all the craziness. And think about the insane drinking. And just give this program a try. And as you work with people, just sort of hang it out there as a beautiful carrot. Because it is. It's an adventure that you couldn't plan with all the money in the world, the adventure you're going to have in Alcoholics Anonymous. One thing, just think about it. You have friends all over the world. You have people that you can get to a new country, new town, flip open a telephone book, and you find a friend. Doesn't make any difference whether you understand each other's language or not, because I found that to be true all over the world. You know, it's funny how when we think about why we drank, I love this little thing that was in a grapevine. I have no idea, a long time ago, and I put it down, and it just makes sense on the way I was thinking. I drank for happiness and became unhappy. I drank for joy and became miserable. I drank for sociability and became argumentative. I drank for sophistication and became obnoxious. I drank for friendship and made enemies. I drank for sleep and woke up tired. I drank for strength and felt weak. I drank for relaxation and got the shakes. I drank for courage and became afraid. I drank for confidence and became doubtful. I drank to feel heavenly and ended up feeling like hell. All the things I drank for, I've gotten in this program just with the tools that are given to us. I'm going to see you this afternoon on step three. Right, step three.